I think Bitcoin actually gives people a tool that makes it a lot easier to actualize liberty, because now you actually can transact without using the fiat system at all. And I think this is one of those really underrated points, because a lot of people think, oh, see, Bitcoin, you Bitcoin people, you're advocating it and you think it's going to change the world and you think it's going to fix all these things. I think the problem with those people is that they simply do not understand just how many things fiat currency has wrecked.
Hello and welcome to Bitcoin with Jake. This is a podcast all about people's personal journeys to Bitcoin. I wanted to know more about the people converging on this new form of money. Why do they see value in it? What skills enable their understanding? How is it changing their lives? If you're a founder looking for funding or an investor looking to make investments, then please reach out as I develop my network in the space. Do me a favor and chuck us a 5-star rating on whichever app you're using to listen, or a like if you're watching it somewhere. As insignificant as this may seem, they help a startup project like this hugely. Lastly, if you have any questions at all, please just reach out. The easiest place to find me is on Twitter at Jake E. S. Woodhouse. Now, I'd like to take a quick moment to talk about our sponsor. Fast Bitcoins are a Bitcoin exchange who you should definitely take a look at next time you're thinking of making a Bitcoin purchase. They're a great team, which for me is always the key to due diligence, whilst their product has a ton of features useful to every Bitcoiner. Check out my episodes with Danny Brewster, the founder CEO, and Nathan Smith, the chief compliance officer, to learn more about the people behind the brand. Thank you to Fast Bitcoins for sponsoring the show. Now, on to today's episode. I'm speaking with Stefan Levera. Welcome, Stefan.
Thanks for inviting me, Jake.
No, my pleasure. I'm very excited to have you on today. I'll be lying if I wasn't a huge fan, and I've been lucky to pile through tons and tons of your content, and it's helped me hugely to understand what Bitcoin is. So yeah, really great moment for me to have you on, and thank you so much for sharing your time.
Hey, yeah, of course. Always happy to spread the word of Bitcoin.
Yeah, well, that's what brings us together, no doubt. So I'll start easily. Everyone has a journey to Bitcoin. Everyone's is different. And that's what I like to discuss in this podcast specifically. So if you could wind the clock back, someone told you about it at some point. Who was that person? Where were you? What was going on at the time? Teach us a bit about your initial interactions with Bitcoin and how you came across it.
Sure. So I'll note that I was an Austro-libertarian, as in a libertarian who is interested in Austrian economics, before Bitcoin. So okay. I was primed in that way, that I was already anti-fiat money. I was already anti-central banking. And I would say I'm not like a developer, but I'm relatively tech savvy. So that was my background going into it. Now, like most people, the first time I heard about Bitcoin, I thought it was a scam. I thought it was Worldcraft, like World of Warcraft money, or like some weird online computer game money. And it's not going to, you know, mean anything. But I just never really clicked into it and never actually looked into it. The actual moment for me, I actually recall roughly the time, it was just such a mind-blowing moment for me. So I read an article by Eric Voorhees. This was in December 2012. Now, I think he had written the article earlier, but I think somehow it got shared in some kind of forum or something, and I somehow stumbled across the link, and that was the moment. Because basically in that article, he spelled out, actually, this is a competition to central banks, and this is actually what Bitcoin could do. And so me, coming from a libertarian perspective, that was very exciting. So that was basically the start of my journey. And so December 2012, there wasn't a lot of good material out there at the time, right? There were some early people. There were people like Andreas Antonopoulos and a few other people like that. And so in that process of early 2013, in those few months, I was going through my process, right? I was reading about it and trying to figure things out based on forum posts and articles. But as you probably are aware, a lot of the articles that were written in the mainstream were just horrible. So to get the good information, you had to be in the know. You had to be on Bitcoin subreddit, or you had to be on Bitcoin Talk, trying to go through and understand from there what Bitcoin actually was. And so that was the process. And at the same time, I was trying to tell people I knew about it. And actually, at that point, that's where my longtime friend Catan, that's where I got him into Bitcoin also. So we were basically going down the rabbit hole together in that way. And so for me, I was already into Austrian economics, so I was already down with that part of it. But certainly early writers and speakers in the space helped me in my knowledge also. People like Andreas Antonopoulos, although I wouldn't qualify him as an Austrian, but he was definitely a big Bitcoin advocate in the early days. Others, people like Trace Mayer, Conrad Graf, my friends over at the Nakamoto Institute, Michael Goldstein, Pierre Richard, and Daniel Krawitz before he kind of went crazy or into BSV. Those were some of my early connections. And so I was on early Bitcoin Twitter back in 2013. Now, Bitcoin Twitter was not a thing back then, but I think that's actually where Pierre Richard and I first connected. And then from that, that's where I sort of got in and made more friends and like online friends and went down that journey, right? And you're buying your first coins, you're running a Bitcoin node. I was running Bitcoin QT back then. That was pre-Bitcoin Core. And I remember playing around with Armory as well. So Armory was basically like the OG, one of the OG Bitcoin wallets. And the setup you could do is you could have this offline Armory. So you had a computer, like an offline computer and an online connected computer. And so this is like hardware wallets before hardware wallets were popular. And that was, those are some of the things in the early days. And I remember when Trezor came out, Trezor being the first hardware wallet. And I don't know if you know this, but do you know the price of the Trezor in the early days?
Oh, couldn't even guess. No, I don't know.
It was one Bitcoin. That was back when about one Bitcoin was about $100. So these are the kinds of things, you know, people did. And this is yeah, in the wow. early days, right? So it was about $100 and people were literally back in then, you would pay a Bitcoin and buy a Trezor, right?
Yeah.
So this is, you know, these are some of the early stories. Now, of course, there was a lot of scams. There was a lot of nonsense in the space too. There was a lot of this kind of blockchain nonsense. There were, you know the early altcoins, things like Namecoin or PP Coin and some of these other coins out there. Of course, I was only interested in Bitcoin because I was interested in the Sound Money case. I might have been curious at those points, like, oh, okay, what's this like Prime Coin or what's this like Namecoin? Is there a purpose for these things? I never bought them or used them or shielded them, but I was just, oh, okay, I'd read an article about it or hear someone talking about it. But yeah, definitely the whole case was about this idea of sound money, this idea of creating a parallel financial system. Those were things that definitely appealed to me and still appeal to me today in terms of what Bitcoin is, what it could do. And of course, that fundamental idea that if enough people adopt Bitcoin, then that will change the relationship between the individual and the state. And this whole notion, of course, as any Bitcoiner knows, separating money from state.
Wow, Stefan, it's so interesting listening to people like yourself talk about 2012, 2013 like this. The last 10 years has literally flown by and you go, whoa, okay. It's incredible the progress that has been made in that time. And yes, obviously people wish they could have got, Bitcoin for $100, but Bitcoin at 20 grand today, in my opinion, is a better investment than it was then. Yes, the appreciation has been extraordinary, but look at what you're buying now. Like you're buying a completely different beast. I think what was the highest hash rate ever achieved in the last week or so. So the network itself is extraordinarily strong now compared to where it was back then. But before we get to analyzing back then and now, I'd like to dig a bit further back than that. And I'm guessing we're similar age. So I'm 34 at the moment. And yeah. Libertarian philosophy is something that's come into my life now. But I was lucky to go to a school in the UK, then a university, did a business management degree. And Austrian economics might have been mentioned as like a side small marketplace within, you know, the general Keynesian macroeconomics that I've guzzled down, basically. And the idea of even questioning the central bank, it just wasn't something that really kind of came across my field of conversation. How did you become interested in Austrian economics and equally libertarianism before 2012, 2013? So before even your mid-20s, you were looking into this stuff.
Yeah, so for me, it comes back to, I was hanging out in some IRC channels when I was a boy. I was maybe 14 or 15. And I was in this politics channel, like Australian politics channel. And this guy kept linking to Mises.org articles. Now, back then, I think it was called Mises Daily. I think it was called then. I think nowadays it's called Mises Wire. But anyway, the point is, there would be these short articles that explain some concept within Austrian economics. Now, when I was 14 or 15, I didn't necessarily have the patience to go and read Human Action, right? These 1,000-page tomes. And reading these little articles, that was more accessible to me. And at first I thought, oh, this is crazy. Like how, right? Because it came up, the context would come up, and basically these articles would come up in the context of anarcho-capitalism. So I'd be thinking, oh no, that's impossible. How wouldn't there be gangs roaming the streets and what would happen? But over time, I found that these articles and these books, the smaller books that I would read over at Mises.org, they made a lot more sense to me than what I was learning at school. The Keynesian stuff, the monetarist stuff, the neoclassical.
And it does. I mean, even now in my mid-30s, I'm looking at some of the content I'm going through, like, oh, that makes sense. Like, human action as a lens makes sense. And the amount of lectures I sat through, I was like, this is bullshit, isn't it? And you don't really concentrate. You don't have any context to it. Just get the grade, get through it, you know, and move on, basically.
Oh, yeah. Interesting. Yeah. Whoa. Yeah. So that was the mindset right back then. I would just basically be a good student by regurgitating what the teacher wanted to hear, because that's what you have to do to get into university. Because back then, I would say university was more, you kind of needed it more. Whereas nowadays, I actually would not. Like, so for example, by the time I have kids and they grow up, I probably wouldn't send them to university unless it was a very specific thing. Just because I think the value for money is terrible, and people can learn online a lot better. Right. And they can go work in a job and get actual skills instead of just having a 4-year party that university ends up being today. But anyway, the point is, you had to play the game. And you had to just regurgitate the Keynesian and neoclassical stuff because that's what the teacher is expecting. And if you try to challenge that paradigm as a student, you're not going to get very far. Yeah, so basically the point is, I was libertarian and believed philosophically and intellectually in this idea of anarcho-capitalism, or at the very least, if we can't have that, at least making the state smaller, right? Lowering the taxes, lowering the regulations as much as possible. So I was already coming from that paradigm. I just didn't know there were other people like me in Australia, right? So I just thought, oh, okay, I'm just kind of on my own out here. I just have this intellectual belief and that's pretty much it. But what I found is that there were other libertarians in Australia, and this is maybe around 2011, 2012. And then Bitcoin obviously made a big difference too, because I think for the most part, the hope for liberty was basically close to zero without Bitcoin. I think Bitcoin actually gives people a tool that makes it a lot easier to actualize liberty, because now you actually can transact without using the fiat system at all. And I think this is one of those really underrated points, because a lot of people think, oh, see, Bitcoin, you Bitcoin people, you're advocating it and you think it's going to change the world and you think it's going to fix all these things. I think the problem with those people is that they simply do not understand just how many things fiat currency has wrecked. They just simply do not appreciate the cultural consequences of fiat money. And so I think these people are the ones who have to stop and really step back and think about what are the implications of living under a fiat standard, right? As my friend Seyfteyn talks about in his book, The Fiat Standard, I think there are many consequences that are downstream of fiat currency. And we are going to undo those slowly. It's not going to happen tomorrow, but we're going to slowly start this process of undoing a lot of the fiat damage that has been caused.
It's one of those things as well, when you start to really look around you and think, fuck, someone has a money printer. And not just a little bit of money here and there, like shitloads of money is being printed. And that gives them extraordinary power over absolutely everything. And the more that you see it, the more you go, oh, wow, it really has seeped into culture in extraordinary ways, seeped into just my day-to-day life. And I think about the family unit in some way. So I'm married, I've got two small kids, I'm living in Australia, not to talk about myself too much, but it's rare that, you know, your wife can comfortably not work at home. Like, both parents are now working, grandparents can't necessarily look after kids because they're also working. The society has just shifted so much in 100 years because of the disintegration of our currency on a day-to-day basis. We can't store any value, and we have to just work and work and work and work, and we're all so stressed and so unhealthy. And then you throw into the mix the extraordinary experience that COVID was, and how lockdowns were chucked in place, how experimental vaccinations were chucked in place, when, like, who's making the shots? Who's calling the shots here? What if I say no? Do you know what I mean? It was just so obvious now that the system's not being built for the average person, but built by the people in charge that are making a shit ton of money. And it's only through the money printer that's able to happen in so many ways. But it's taken me a lot of work to get to that point to kind of see that. Yeah, wow, okay, right. Cool.
And so the way I'm seeing it is that it's not even that there's some evil mastermind genius pulling the strings. It's more like society just hollowed itself out. So society hollowed itself out, and we no longer have adults in charge. We just have perpetual children in charge. They think, oh, wind and solar, unreliable energy is going to power the world. Oh, look, we can just shut down society and not worry about producing things. Oh, we can just lock down the world when this disease is not really, it's just not that bad to justify shutting down all of the world. And fundamentally, remember, it's wrong in principle as well. The property rights angle, right? People who own property should be the ones who decide. That would have been the actually correct way to go about all of this. But unfortunately, we are not ruled over or governed by adult serious people nowadays. We are being governed over by children who fundamentally, they are like intellectually, they are children, right? They just simply have not appreciated that there are fundamental trade-offs and limits to society, and there are fundamental things we have to do. Like, we have to produce, we need reliable energy, we need things to be cost-effective for people. We can't just create this crazy housing bubble that makes it just completely unaffordable for the average person. And if you look at what's happened over the last 30, 40 years, the generation one generation, like the Gen X or the baby boomers particularly, they had it so much easier in that way. Now, of course, you could argue they had difficulties in other ways, but that generation fundamentally has been driving a lot of the political decisions about things in many countries around the world. And they have just driven this scenario where the default scenario now is you have to store value in your house. Basically, everyone has to have a big mortgage. Now, of course, I'm anti that. Obviously, I believe you should save with Bitcoin. But generally speaking, that's been the paradigm. That's the paradigm they've pushed the world into is save into housing or save into stocks or save into bonds. And now the price, the bill is coming due because the average person who's coming up, let's say around our age, you and me, or slightly younger than us, they're effectively locked out, or they have to basically lever up to the hilt to even be able to get their foot in the door to get a home, right? And I know even in Australia, I don't watch the Australian news too closely, but it looks like the big front page news nowadays in Australia, as we speak, at least in November 2022, is now, oh, look, all these mortgages, all these people with mortgages are going to get wrecked because interest rates are going on the way back up. And a lot of them were effectively pushed into taking out these massive loans at the time when interest rates were extremely low. And now that the interest rates are normalizing back, a lot of people are getting wrecked, which is sad to see.
Yeah, well, it's entirely predictable, which is slightly unfair on... Oh, yeah. Anyway, there's so many angles we could go with this, Stefan. I share a lot of your views. Let's go this way. I'd love to draw back to 2011 or so, which you were mentioning, and you were interested in Austrian economics and sound money, and Bitcoin comes along. Can you remember that moment when you first realized, holy shit, this is actually a way of disrupting central banks? And when I first heard, it was actually Saifedean talk about it with that phrase. I spent many years in the startup space, and startups all about disruption. What are you disrupting? What are you disrupting? Yeah. What are you disrupting? And I heard him say, we're going to disrupt central banking. And I was like, holy shit, that's actually so massive. What does that mean? Yeah, think back. Oh, this actually ties together so brilliantly with a worldview that I had. What did it mean to you?
Yeah, absolutely. So for me, like I mentioned, right, from the age of say 14 or 15, I was going down that libertarian rabbit hole. So by the time I had gotten to, let's say, 17, 18, I was fully libertarian, believed central banking was wrong. Basically, I just...
so niche. You know,
but I was on my own, right? And so, yeah. And then Ron Paul definitely deserves a lot of credit for popularizing this idea out to the rest of the world, right? Because up until his presidential campaigns, and of course, I know he was talking about it even earlier, but he was one of the few people talking about this thing that so few other people even understood. Like, a lot of other people didn't even know about the Federal Reserve. They didn't even know, they didn't even understand that their money was no longer linked to gold, right? Especially in the US, right? After 1971, a lot of people still didn't, even if you ask a random person on the street today, they probably wouldn't know that, right? They wouldn't really be able to explain anything about that. So anyway, the point is, Ron Paul definitely deserves a lot of the credit for popularizing this idea, and I believe Bitcoiners are taking it and putting it into practice. And so for me, December 2012, as I mentioned, I was just mind blown. Like, to me, I was reading, and because for me, I had already accepted this idea that central banking is a scam, fiat money is wrong, the state is basically not a good thing for you and you should be skeptical of it. I had already fully accepted all of those ideas. So for me, just seeing Bitcoin and thinking, oh, wow, like, we could actually disrupt central banks. And actually, this is one of those things that I have long been thinking in the space, and obviously other people in the space also who are coming from that more Austrian angle, we view Bitcoin as challenging central banks more than it challenges banking. But it's interesting, the rhetoric, because in some of the early days of Bitcoin, people like Andreas, and in fact, I spoke about that with Andreas on an episode with him. I think off the top of my head, it's like episode 53 or so. So we're going back, you know, 3 or 4 years now at this point. But yeah, I spoke about that with him, that, and I've spoken about that. I think this is perhaps one slight difference between some early Bitcoiners where they were just anti-banking in general. So if you look at some of the rhetoric back then, it was, oh, look, banks aren't open on the weekends. They're only open from 9 to 5 or even 9 to 4 in some cases, and you pay all this money for fees. So there was this low fee narrative, right? And that was back in those days. And people spoke a lot about remittance and all of these angles of, oh, you've got to pay fees, you've got to sit on the phone call line, etc. But you fast forward now today, and now a lot of the fiat payment rails, especially like in Australia, has the NPP, National Payments Platform, on which PayID and OSCO and some of these other platforms are operating. So now you can transact outside of banking hours. Now you can send money instantly, fiat money, of course, fiat currency. So in that world, what is Bitcoin challenging? Well, it's challenging the fundamental underlying money, the money unit. And so it does force us to be clear about what are we challenging? What are we disrupting? And so my view was more that Bitcoin challenges central banks more than it challenges banking. And we saw some of the rhetoric would be, oh, you know, look at all the high fees you pay with your banks. Whereas from my point of view, it might be that to pay on-chain, let's say, maybe not today, right? If we're talking today, you might be paying 50 cents for an on-chain fee. But let's say in 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, it might cost a lot of money to transact on-chain. And this obviously comes into that whole small block, big block, scaling war, block size war that Bitcoin went through in 2015, 16, and culminating in 2017. But fundamentally, I view Bitcoin more like safety did. A bunch of us in the Austrian camp were saying, no, it's about challenging central banks. There may still be a role for some Bitcoin banking provider who helps you, right? So an example is like an Unchained Capital who's helping. They may hold one of your keys and they help you with offering loans against that. Or you may have another provider who holds, who helps you from a security point of view. Or of course, if you want to be fully self-sovereign, the tools are there. You can run your own Bitcoin node. You can do your own multi-signature. All of that is there. But to your question, yeah, it is fundamentally challenging central banking and this idea that we have to transact between different foreign currencies all the time. Right now, recently, I was traveling around a bit. I was in Amsterdam for Bitcoin Amsterdam. Then I was in Prague for Liberty in Our Lifetime. And then I was in Lugano, all of which are using different fiat currencies because Amsterdam, they're using the euro. In Czech Republic, they're part of the euro, but they use Czech, their currency is CZK. So it's another currency altogether. Then I was in Lugano where they're using Swiss francs because they're not part of the EU, but they're part of the Schengen zone, etc. Right. So there's a whole, you know, think about it. All those times you had to go back and change your money or change a little bit. Now, thankfully, in some of those places, I was able to just pay with Bitcoin and use my own Bitcoin Lightning wallet. And so that's really cool. Right. But we're still early in this overall process. And so I think having that clarity of thought about what are we really challenging, it does matter. But I think that's also where, let's say, the Bitcoin Austrian view has risen in prominence. Whereas I would say back in 2013 and 14, that Bitcoin Austrian view as espoused by people like, back in those days, Konrad Graf, Peter Serda, Pierre Richard, Michael Goldstein, and to a lesser extent myself, I was writing a few articles back in those days too, but not as well-read as those, like it wasn't as popular as those, their articles and work. And then I think post the publication of the Bitcoin standard, now that Austro-libertarian Bitcoin Austrian view has become a lot more prominent, I would say. And a lot more people understand that idea.
And it's, to me anyway, that was really a penny drop moment in terms of, okay, actually, there's lots of symptoms I see in the world today, i.e. lots of problems. What's genuinely at the root cause of those problems? Now, banking fees, for example, that's not the actual problem here. They're enabled by central banks in some ways to behave the way they do. But if Bitcoin was to usurp central banks' positions in the economy today, they would make money providing value of some form, like you mentioned the Unchained example, to customers that are using Bitcoin. Like, they'll still exist because they'll be able to operate within a Bitcoin standard in theory. Whereas a central bank, they're just completely and utterly obsolete. You just wouldn't use one. And that to me is really interesting because it's like, okay, well, what does that mean certainly as entrepreneurs, like what can we build? What doesn't exist today that is required in the future? And how can you solve some problems and how can you start delivering value? And that's when you go down the rabbit hole of, whoa, there's some serious creative juices that are flying around this space that are going to change a lot of stuff.
One comment on the central banking thing. Now, of course, I would love to live on a Bitcoin standard. I think that would be a much better place for the world. But you know what? It's possible in the future that there is a monetary North Korea. Or that there's some country who forces their citizens and residents to transact in their local fiat shitcoin. But that said, obviously the benefits of living on a Bitcoin standard will show themselves for those countries and those states and those people fundamentally who do choose to transact with Bitcoin. And to your second point around what kinds of things can we build, I think seeing what's being built today on the Lightning Network is a great example, because people can do these little small paywalls. They can do things like log in using your Lightning wallet. And so there are examples there that people are using Bitcoin and Bitcoin-related applications to achieve things that were otherwise not feasible or not easily possible. And of course, just providing access to people who are otherwise shut out of the fiat system. Because as we're seeing, they are canceling more and more people. They canceled Kanye West out of the fiat system. They canceled the Free Speech Union. They, you know, if you are in a person living in Iran, you have been canceled by the US sanctions regime, and through no fault of your own. Right now, of course, maybe the politicians and the people at the top of these jurisdictions, maybe they are to blame. But if you're just an innocent Iranian or potentially an innocent Russian, you've just been financially canceled from all of these US banking and other related products and services. And yet it's through no fault of your own. Just by being born in this country or being the child of somebody from that country, you're just canceled. So it's crazy that we're living in that world today and a lot of people aren't willing to speak up about it. And yet there are tools like obviously Bitcoin that allows you to still transact anyway. At least financially, you can still operate using Bitcoin. I think that is an obvious example. And so over time, we're going to see more and more people get canceled, and eventually they're going to join us here in the Bitcoin rabbit hole.
Yeah, the cancel culture will only increase over time, you assume, as the existing system, let's say the traditional system, as it starts to be threatened further and further with extinction, it will start lashing out more and more, just like any aging animal would in the natural world. They're going to hurt some things as they go down fighting, but they're going to go down inevitably. A couple of people it brings to mind that have been on the show already. So Robert Breedlove told a great story, and he was very much down the rabbit hole having read things like The Creature from Jekyll Island and the problem that central banking posed, but there just wasn't a solution. So as a 20-year-old, he just not forgot about it, but just, you know, his life moved on. And then it wasn't until Bitcoin really came along and he went down the hole, he's like, oh fuck yes, this is actually something that's gonna solve the problem I saw those years ago. And I also had the El Sultan Bitcoin on, who episode I released just a couple of days ago, talking about life in Caracas growing up. And it was actually US sanctions that were one of the major reasons behind the hyperinflation that ended up happening in Venezuela. And to your point, like Venezuela just got canceled. Okay, cool. Well, what happens when you have a left-leaning centralized government? Will you end up in the situation that they were in? Yeah, it's so interesting, isn't it, how you can kind of draw all these different points together and see where it goes. So, Stefan, I'm intrigued as to today you are very much a prominent figure in the Bitcoin space, working full-time in the Bitcoin space. Back in 2013 or so, I imagine you had a job in fiat land. So talk to me a bit about that. Over time, you've obviously, it's become more and more a part of your life and who you are today and what you focus on. But that probably wasn't always the case. So what brought you to where you are now in that sense?
Yeah, so for me, I saw it as I'm just going to keep working and stacking, right? So I was working in the fiat mines. I was working in companies. Now, I had arguably a decent, I guess, fiat privilege, to be clear. Like, I went to university. I started working at Deloitte, right? So people who know them, like, they're one of the big four, the professional consulting companies. So I started my career there. I was working in...
As an accountant or in the consultancy department or... Cause they're so
Yeah, so I was in the risk so services. Basically, stuff. I was doing like internal audit and consulting like around that. So they would send us out to do sort of internal audits, but for clients. And then after that, I went into banking as well, because at the time I had some misgivings about that, because I was sort of like, oh, I think modern day fractional banking is basically a scam. But at the same time, it's like, don't hate the player, hate the game. So I was like, well, okay, I'll just go and work in the banking environment and do what I can just to save from there and then see what happens after that. And so basically I was working in banking I was working at the Commonwealth Bank of Australia. And then around that time, I had a decent stint there. I was there for about 3.5 years. But around basically the 2017-18 cycle, I was getting really frustrated with all the shitcoining and blockchaining going on out there, right? And I would try to listen to some information in the space, but there just wasn't a lot of good stuff out there. There was just a lot of just shilling, right? And so at the time I started my podcast, which was in the 2018 bear cycle, basically, there wasn't a lot out there, right? There was basically Noted, my friends, Michael and Pierre, Noted Bitcoin Podcast, and Tales from the Crypt, Marty Bent. So that was pretty much all there was at the time in terms of regular Bitcoin podcast material, because other than that, it was just a lot of shitcoin shilling and blockchain technology nonsense. And so for me, I didn't even start the podcast as a business venture. It was just literally, I'm so frustrated with the amount of garbage information out there that I'm just going to fix it myself. And I'm just going to provide a high signal podcast that people can listen to and actually learn real technology about Bitcoin and real economics about Bitcoin. And at the time I started it, there were very few other people doing what I was doing. Now, as I mentioned, there's Noted and Tales from the Crypt. Other than that, yes, there was Let's Talk Bitcoin from in the early 2013 days, but they were sort of irregular and they had kind of gone into shitcoining as well. They started their own shitcoin as well. So I was just annoyed about that. And there was Trace Mayer. He had this Bitcoin Knowledge podcast, which was also good, but also very irregular at the time. And so, yeah, basically at the time I started the podcast, there was a dearth of good quality interview material. And so awesome. I was basically just trying to scratch my own itch and just say, look, I want this to be out there. I want there to be a good solid pathway that people can just go to. People can send them to my podcast or find some of my material and I'll just be that person. So fine, I'll just curate and I'll just be the interviewer. That's going to be what I'll do. Now, I wasn't even intending that as a career. I was just doing this on the side. It was a labor of love. I just was working in my fiat mining job and just doing this on the side just to put it out there, just to have this available. And so it was only later, once I had grown enough of a listener base and a following and I was getting people wanting to sponsor the show, or I was getting conferences who wanted to invite me, and then it became more and more difficult to sustain the fiat banking lifestyle job, to retain that fiat banking job, that then I eventually just thought, okay, let's just do this. Let's just make this the thing. And so that was where this whole podcast, that's the journey of how this podcast went down for me. So
I love it.
Basically, started as a labor of love, was just something I was doing just because I wanted it to exist, and then later professionalized and became an actual show with sponsors and everything.
It's very inspirational for someone like myself who's just kicking off on this journey. So it's great to hear how it worked out. So just from a selfish perspective, I'm intrigued as to how, like, what were some of those early few episodes like, and what was the thing that you found the most difficult? Like, listening to yourself is quite hard to start with, for example. And then, you know, who am I going to ask on? And like, how do I actually even do this? What caused you the biggest headaches as you started?
Right. So for me, I was fortunate that I was already friends with a bunch of people in the background. So I was already friends with Safe Dean. And so actually Safe Dean was guest number one. So if you go back to Stefan Levera episode one, it's Safe Dean. Awesome. And then so the first few shows, it was people like Safe Dean, VJ Boyapati, Pierre Rochard, Michael Goldstein. Like, these were people who I was chatting with in the background anyway. And so I was fortunate in that way. I think it was a bit of right place, right time, because remember, at the time that I started the show, there wasn't a lot out there. Nowadays, of course, if you look out there now, yeah, there's a ton of shows out there with a ton of different voices and different focus areas that they might have. So, for example, there's people who are focused only on mining. There are people who are focused only on a certain country, or let's say the content that's only in that language, right? If it's Italian or some other, you know, whatever language. But at the time, there was just a dearth. There was a serious dearth of content. So I think a little bit was just right place, right time. Things like that. Otherwise, yeah, I think I had to learn various aspects about producing the show. So I had to figure out, okay, what platform am I using to host it? How am I going to put this out there? And I think I just got lucky as well. Like, I think there's an element of luck and there's an element of work that I just had to put in a lot of work. I put in a lot of time researching. And I think that was what distinguished my show from the stuff that was out there, that people would know, oh, okay, there's a certain level of detail that Stefan will go into when he's doing his interviews. And in many cases, listeners can't really get that elsewhere. So that's what keeps people coming back.
Well, it's what I would describe as good entrepreneurship. Like, you saw a problem. In fact, it was your own problem, and it pissed you off so much that you wanted to solve it yourself. In fact, and in my mind, so I've done some angel investing and stuff in the past and really love the idea of building businesses. Some of the best businesses you can ever invest into are people that are just scratching their own itch, and they're brilliantly suited to what they're actually creating because it was their problem in the first place. And I love hearing stories like that because they're so unique. It's like, what problem did you have? Well, I actually had it myself. Okay, well, that means that a few other people might have the same problem. Who knows? And then boom, here you are today. Awesome. Well, Stefan, thank you so much for sharing all that. Do you think there's any, and this is just a budding podcast to myself, any key to like audience growth? I assume it's about delivering unique and high quality content, but is there any kind of magic sauce to it that you'd be able to share or just really focus on? I don't know. You let me know.
I would say have a few things that you're known for. I think that helps because once you've been out there for a while, what keeps people coming back is having your own reputation and your own brand in the space. So that helps you then when you're trying to get guests on, it helps you because you've made those contacts. I think doing the right amount of research as well for each show so that people are getting an in-depth conversation and something useful. Where possible, try to minimize LARPing, right? Use the product if you can, or use that software, or do some research where possible, because then that gives people more of an in-depth conversation about that thing, whatever it is. Now, not always possible, it's not always feasible, but where you can, yeah, it's worthwhile. I think also for me, I had to increase my knowledge from the technical side. So I think coming into it, I was definitely more on the economics aspect and more on the economics side of Bitcoin. Over those years, I've had to learn and improve my own technical knowledge of Bitcoin. Not to the point where I'm necessarily a developer, but I can at least hold a conversation with a developer. And so that's at least been useful for me. Of course, it depends what kind of show you're going to do, right? If you're going to be a mining specialist, well, then you just have to, you have to be a craftsman in terms of really knowing your own specific area. Whereas I think I see myself more like a Bitcoin generalist, right? So I have to know enough about these different topics, whether it's privacy, whether it's security, whether it's Bitcoin protocol, whether it's Lightning stuff, whether it's mining. I have to know at least a little bit about all these different topics. Whereas maybe the opportunity then is if you're a specialist and you're trying to be the best at a certain area, like if you're trying to be the best at mining in this area or Lightning Network on this thing, or I think that's the opportunity, and it takes consistency to really build it up over time. Because I'll tell you what, there are a lot of people who start shows and things, but there's not a lot of people who keep them going for years and years on end. I think that consistency also matters because it helps in terms of audience listenership, and it helps in terms of getting people on the show. Because if you have an established show, then it's more well known. It's easier for them to get that idea. They say, oh, Stefan's been running his show for years. And, you know, other opportunities will come to you as well over time, right? Because if you're known in the space for doing a certain thing, then maybe people will come to you and say, oh, I've got this investment opportunity, or maybe you can help advise on this other Bitcoin project or startup, or maybe even job opportunities can come to you. So I think, yeah, but at the end of the day, like you said, it comes down to trying to solve a problem for customers in a way. And so for me, I view that problem is how do people stay up to date technically and economically on what's going on in the space? And so I just try to deliver what I think will be educational and interesting for listeners in the interview format.
And you do an amazing job of it. I always love tuning in and listening, and it's straight to the point. And I learn a lot in each conversation. And the people that you get onto your show have great stories and are building really interesting stuff. And something that I was looking for in particular was, okay, so I was managing inheritance. My father died young and I had this money and I'm like, and what do I do with this thing? And I've been looking for 10 years or so of investing in different asset classes. And I eventually come across Bitcoin. Having, you know, a tiny percentage of my portfolio was in Bitcoin from 2015. That obviously grew over time until 2020 comes along. And I'm like, holy shit, this is taking all of my mental capacity. What an interesting thing. And now here I am. I've completely changed my portfolio allocation to as much Bitcoin as possible. And I'm starting a Bitcoin podcast and going full time into it. It's the most exciting thing ever in my mind. But what I'm looking for is legitimacy. It's like, you know, you deal with financial advisors and they're this kind of professional entity and they're like, oh, wow, trust me with your money. You can let me do all this complex stuff. And at the end of the year, you get this beautiful little portfolio that you have no idea what's in it. And we take you for a nice lunch and we've still made 1% regardless of performance. Wing, wing, everything's great. And you're like, okay, cool. But Bitcoin's different. You have to go and teach yourself everything. And so when I've been able to tune into your show, it's like, oh, fucking hell, look at all these people that are building cool things that have, you know, interesting backgrounds that are doing it because they think it's not only important, i.e. it's mission driven, but there's a genuine need for it. Like, well, this is really compelling place to start focusing your energy and also capital. So no, it's been very inspirational for me, Stefan. Thank you. So where I want to go now is I tend to do some audience questions. So shout out to the Wizard of Oz. I went along to one of the Bush Bashes, which was great. And I met your great friend Katan, who said, oh, Stefan's mad. He was already a libertarian before Bitcoin came along. I was like, who is this guy? Okay, got to have a chat with him at some stage. But he says, how does Stefan see the learning journey in Bitcoin through the first, second, and third cycles? That is, how has your perspective changed over those cycles?
Yeah, so coming back to what I was saying earlier, I think I came into this space from the libertarian economics perspective. I had to learn a lot on the technical side. Now, I was a tech savvy person, but I was, like I said, I was not a developer. So I would say that's probably the biggest shift over the years is I've had to really understand and really try to learn, not that I'm some technical expert, but I try to understand, okay, what is FOSS? What's open source? What's this ethos? And these aspects around how to actually use it in practice. So I think those are probably the big things I've had to do my own learning. And whether that comes to reading books on Bitcoin, things like Grokking Bitcoin by Carly Rosenbaum is a great example, or looking at some of the work of people like Jimmy Song, right, who's teaching about Bitcoin development, trying to understand the process so that I could do better interviews and also just understand it for myself also, the process of Bitcoin development and open source development in general and how it works here in the community. As an example, that there might be some community projects that you try to support them because maybe they're doing a Bitcoin open source wallet that you want this project to exist, right? An example might be Zeus, which is a FOSS Lightning wallet that I use, and I help promote them as well because they're just a FOSS wallet. They're just an open source project. So those are some things I've learned. Of course, I've had to learn a lot of things about podcasting and audio stuff because I certainly was not an expert in that. Over time in the space, let's just talk cycles. So as I mentioned, I came in, let's say December 2012, early 2013, and I was there for that 2013, let's say double cycle, if you will. And so I think early learnings for me in that space were watch out for the scams, right? There have always been scams in the space. Be careful of those. And I had to learn some hard lessons along the way, things like a non-custodial wallets. In the earlier days, people didn't understand that because in those days, the saying, not your keys, not your coins, was not coined yet. I think Andreas coined and popularized that in maybe 2014 or 15, right? So back in those days, the understanding was not there. And I had a much better understanding. Like, I was running Bitcoin QT at points and I was running Bitcoin Armory and things like this, but I didn't really deeply get this idea of what it was to run a Bitcoin node, right? Because I was just doing it because that was the main way you interacted. And then later, when it came to the 2017 cycle, that's when it became a lot more important to understand, this is actually why you run a Bitcoin node. So Katana and I have this joke that we used to joke around, this idea of, you're saving the network or whatever just by running a Bitcoin node. But the joke is that that's actually not saving the network, right? Actually, what's helping is for you to learn to validate or verify your own transactions on your Bitcoin node. Not just quite naively running the Bitcoin node and just leaving it there and joking about how many outbound connections you have or whatever, because, okay, yeah, you could argue maybe it helps in the sense that you're quote unquote seeding a useful file, like in BitTorrent, when people are seeding, you're seeding a useful file, the ledger of Bitcoin, you're keeping another, you know, copy of it. But really what really protects the network is enough users, decentralized validation. That's actually what protects the system in that way. And I had an episode with Luke Dasher talking about that and his reflections on UASF and the 2017 SegWit saga. So I would say that was probably a big learning there. Otherwise, other learnings, I grew up being relatively a savings kind of person, that I like to save money. So I think that also helped me see Bitcoin as this idea of savings technology. And of course, my great friend, Pierre Richard, gets the credit, I think, for memeing that and popularizing that idea, the savings technology. And of course, our Australian friend, Friar Haas, or Haas McCook, and his DCA narrative. I think that's also really cool. I think promoting that idea of DCA, just regularly save, stacking sats, these are all good things to promote for Bitcoin, because the more people we get into using Bitcoin non-custodially and stacking sats and saving over time, the better this process will go. So those are some of the learnings for me. But yeah, I would say since doing the podcast, I had to learn a lot more technically to be able to conduct a good interview, because some of my guests are developers themselves. So I would need to be able to meet them where they're at, but at the same time, remember where some of my listeners are and then try to explain in English, what did that developer just say? So that's probably, arguably, that's also something that I'm known for, right? When I do my interviews, I sort of take a second and stop and say, okay, actually, here's what that means for listeners. If you're new, this is what it means. So I think those are probably the key things that I've had to learn, is just to understand who's your audience and to improve technically.
And it strikes me that the process, it's almost like you can look back. I don't know how many episodes you've done now, Stefan. How many?
Over 400 now, 420, over 400. Wow. 430.
So it is very much, I like this concept of learning in public. And you could argue that's 400 hours, whatever, how many, you know, a lot more hours than that in total have gone into producing it, of course. But 400 hours of interview conversations in which you've been able to learn in public from people that you're interviewing. And your natural tendency was towards that kind of technical simplification side of things. Now, another podcast host might go in a different direction, but that's just the natural process of it, and why it's so cool when someone scratches their own itch, because that creativity takes them in a direction that they drive. Like you decided that's okay. It naturally went that way. It's really cool to hear how you ended up at that point. I have another question. This is from Bitcoin Jiu-Jitsu. He wants to know about setting up business entities in Dubai. Now, I'd like to kind of shoehorn a question of my own into there, which is more along the lines of like, why are you not living in Australia any longer? And how did you end up in Dubai?
Yeah, so let me start this way. So 2020 changed a lot of things for me. Now, I've mentioned some of this publicly and so on, but I'll give just a kind of the quick overview. Basically, I was really disappointed with the way Australians responded to the hysteria. Fundamentally, there was no justification for lockdowns, travel bans, mandates, you know, mask mandates, vaccine mandates, all of this. And I just got the sense that the culture was going the wrong way, that unfortunately, even if there was a small pocket of people who I liked and who I agreed with, call it the Bitcoiners, the Libertarians, and some of my family and friends, the vast majority of Australians, over 80% of them, just went with the COVID narrative, right? The hysteria narrative. And especially given that Australia is a high tax country, the juice was simply not worth the squeeze, given that I had the possibility of just finding another jurisdiction. Playing the geo arbitrage game allowed me to change my affairs such that I'm no longer based in Australia. I've cut pretty much every tie that I possibly could from an economic perspective with Australia, so that I could make it very clear that I'm leaving Australia and I'm going into this other jurisdiction with zero personal income tax. And if you read a popular book in the space is The Sovereign Individual. And there's a very infamous line in that book where they basically mention, now I can't remember the exact statistics, but the line goes like this. For every $5,000 in tax that you could save, if you invested that and compounded that for 30 or 40 years, it ends up being tens of millions of dollars. It's like some crazy amount, because again, compound interest is the eighth wonder of the world. Most people don't stop and think about that and think, okay, how much is it really costing me to stay living in this high tax country? And so if you really stop and think about that, if you really stop and run the numbers and you think, okay, you're relatively early in your career. If you go out now and you save that money and you stack those sats, if that ends up being tens of millions of dollars in fiat terms or tens or hundreds of Bitcoin in Bitcoin terms, it's massive. And so then at the end of your life, if you then decide, oh, okay, then I could put that in other things, whatever other cause you believe in, whether it's Austrian economics, whether it's Bitcoin and FOSS development, whether it's charity work to feed children or homeless people. There's all kinds of things you could do with that money rather than letting it go to waste by these fundamentally children in power. These are children in power who are just wasting and squandering taxpayers' money on just useless things. They're concerned about woke causes of the day. And if they were more rational, they would be looking at actually delivering value adding services or trying to make sure they have reliable power so that they can have their air conditioning or use their industrial machinery. And what we've seen is a lot of these countries have just basically chased away industrial production because they're trying to go all woke and green. And we've seen this happen with Germany, sadly, is that Germany is de-industrializing themselves because of their woke fascination with all this green, lefty, unreliable nonsense. So that's kind of in a nutshell why I thought, you know what, I want to get out of Australia. And so that's what I've done. Now, in terms of, I wouldn't say I'm never going back, maybe never is a strong word, but basically it has to be an extreme scenario. It has to be like a funeral, or it has to be maybe my mom or dad are in hospital, you know, this kind of thing. It would have to be like that for me to go back, basically. I've just had it, and I don't see, I just don't want to go back there. So I just want to make that really clear. So yeah, I think for anyone interested in the whole Dubai thing, there are different options. One is to go as a freelancer. So there are different freelancing opportunities that you can go and get a freelancing license. And then off of that, you can do things. Another way is to set up a company. So for example, there are some of these agencies where they can coach you through and consult with you on what kind of company you need to set up, whether it's a mainland company or a free zone company. And then those free zone companies can potentially pay zero corporate tax. And then you as an individual have zero personal income tax in Dubai.
Wow.
Now, you will pay, there is a sales tax when you buy things. So I think it's 5% sales tax. Mm-hmm. And there are licensing fees that you pay ongoing. But so long as you're earning enough, the tax savings are just dramatic. So that's one thing. Now, there are trade-offs, right? Dubai is not, you know, there are some things that you have to learn to deal with in Dubai. So for example, it gets really hot. Let's say April to September time, it gets really hot. We're talking 45, potentially 50 degrees Celsius. So basically during that time of year, you don't spend a lot of time outside. You basically spend it inside in aircon. There's not a lot of green and nature stuff. That's probably a downside. But that said, they are working on a lot of these things. They're improving a lot of these things. So from that point of view, I think it's a really interesting jurisdiction. Pretty good infrastructure wise. You can fly around really easily. So it's as a travel hub, it's easy to fly. So for me, that makes a lot of sense that I can one flight go to places for conferences or whatever. And of course, I have relatives in Sri Lanka too. So it's easy. It's a short flight. It's only 4.5 hours between Dubai and Sri Lanka. So for me personally, it makes a lot of sense. And I'm not saying it's one size fits all. Maybe for you or for other people, it doesn't make as much sense. But for me and my family, yeah, it did. So that's kind of the nutshell there. And I recently became an organizer of Bitcoin Dubai as well. So I was an organizer of Bitcoin Sydney back when I was there. And so I'm going to try to grow the Bitcoin scene when, wherever and however I can. Bitcoin Dubai is going to be something I'm going to try start to drive, at least locally. And of course, doing all the podcast stuff and articles and whatever else I'm doing to try to spread the word of Bitcoin.
No, and you do an excellent job of it. It's something I've talked about on the pod before, and it's really, it's blatantly obvious as soon as you start looking at Bitcoin, the idea of digital assets and not having to own housing or factories or cafes or restaurants or pubs or whatever for your income. You can actually just own something in the cyberspace that you can take anywhere at any time. And that actually gives you leverage over, you know, you got pissed off with the country that you grew up in and you left. Thanks very much. And I love the idea long term of what that means for, they talk about brain funnels and brain drains. And I lived in Singapore for a while, and it was insane how many smart people had been drawn to Singapore because of the tax jurisdiction and what they then created. 50 years ago, Singapore was on the bottom of Malaysia and there was nothing happening there. And it's now like the beast of Asian finance of Southeast Asia. It's extraordinary what they've built in that time. And of course, there are some question marks over autocratic governance and other issues that come up. But it's a very, very interesting thing to be watching play out. And I've recently been looking into Madeira. I've got Andre Loja coming on the show. So
yeah,
that's another place I'm interested in. Obviously, El Salvador's top of that list as well. I've got two small kids. I'm not actually very happy with life in Australia in that sense either. So where does that take my wife and I? And she's Aussie, so family's here and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, we'll work it out. Stefan, do you have another 5 minutes by any chance?
Yeah, sure.
I have a question from Konza. Shout out to Konza, wherever he is in Melbourne somewhere. He asks, what could Nayib Bukele do better? And this is in relation to like a tweet thread he's created before. So I don't know if it's something you interacted with yourself, but from what I could read, the gist of it being you've got a centralized government. He's pretty autocratic. That doesn't mean it's a great vibe in the lens of an Austrian economist. So do you have any comments on that at all?
Yeah, I like Konza. We share an ideological alignment, right? Like he's big into Austrian economics and libertarianism and Bitcoin and stuff. So certainly I like his perspective on a lot of things too. I think it's one thing we can talk about what's intellectually better. I think in practice, it's difficult to achieve a lot of those things. I think maybe Konza's critique of Bekele is that he wants there to be a free trade agreement, he wants there to be an absence of regulation such that there is free trade, right? So what often I think, and we've seen this critique come from libertarian-minded economists, which is that managed trade is not free trade. So I think he was commenting about how, I think he was quoting some sections where basically pointing out how some of these free trade agreements actually are hundreds of pages and they're spelling out all these regulations, when in practice, you could have a very short few sentences of saying, you know, no tariffs, no regulations, just open trade. So of course, I agree that would be better intellectually. I just think the question is, in practice, what can you achieve? And so I know there has been a lot of criticism of what's going on in El Salvador. I understand people say, oh, look, see how you, what happened to these Bitcoin bonds? What happened to this whole citizenship by investment or residence by investment thing? But as I understand from the Bukele government, their answer is that they had to spend a lot of time dealing with the gangs. And so if it wasn't for that, they might have been able to make faster progress on some of those other aspects like the Bitcoin bond and so on. I understand the point about bottom up versus top down. I obviously, as a libertarian, prefer the bottom up adoption of Bitcoin. I see it also, though, that they, while not perfect, they could have been a lot worse. El Salvador could have started their own shitcoin. They could have been very open to shitcoins. I think it's that we have people there, people like Max Keiser and Stacey Herbert, who are in there and trying to Bitcoinize and help them educate and promote this idea of Bitcoin is going there. I'm open to the idea of it maybe in the future, maybe not right now, because as I mentioned, Dubai is probably the best place for me and my family for now. But I'd be open to it in the future, potentially going to El Salvador. But I also appreciate, yes, there are critiques, right? There's no, unfortunately, there's nowhere anarcho-capitalism. It does not exist today in the world. I wish it did, but we have to work with what we've got. And if they are at least speaking out against fiat currency, speaking out against the Federal Reserve, as Nayib Bukele is doing, then that's at least something. And I'll take what I can get, basically.
The phrase pick your battles comes to mind. It's amazing progress they have made. I really enjoyed Alex Gladstein's article, The Village and the Strong Man, if you haven't ever looked at that. And it talks in good detail as to like how the governance of El Salvador is evolving over time and how authoritarian Bukele is potentially becoming. And is that actually a good thing? Because his brand is fantastic right now. It's very popular. And obviously all Bitcoiners are like, fucking legend. Pinch of salt, basically. It's very interesting to see how it plays out and how nation states deal with Bitcoin, how they adopt it. There's this amazing game theory in play. So, you know, I'm a driven, interested entrepreneur who will invest capital and time into something. I'm extremely interested in doing it somewhere where the foundations for that project are completely secure. So if I'm in Australia, which recently caused some problems for some Bitcoin-denominated businesses fucking around with their bank accounts, I don't want to start a company here. So I'm going to leave. And there'll be somewhere else. It's like, yeah, we'll make it really, really clear that we'll never, ever do anything like that to fuck you around. And you get to live in this place and build a digital business on a beach or wherever you might be able to be with your family or who knows. So it's a fascinating process to watch play out.
Yeah. And partly what we're seeing is challenger nations or smaller states giving a better deal in some ways. We're seeing this, right? We're seeing a lot of the big Western nations are acting like they're too cool to have to. And that, unfortunately, will lead to brain drain. A lot of people will leave. And so some of the interesting jurisdictions, at least that I'm seeing. So obviously, the UAE and Dubai, I think, is an interesting one. I think Isle of Man is an interesting one because I think, if I recall, they have no capital gains tax and they have a pretty low corporate tax. I think it's 10 or 15%. So that's an interesting one. Obviously, El Salvador, right? Bitcoin legal tender. The Madeira thing as well. So I know they're going to have some tax incentives for Bitcoin businesses, not necessarily Bitcoin businesses, but businesses inside, I think, a particular free zone or trade zone they have where it's a lower tax. So those are a few examples. And of course, you know, places without capital gains tax could be interesting too, right? Like Switzerland and places like this. Singapore as well, potentially. Although Singapore were a little bit higher on the corona hysteria side. We'll see. But from a financial standpoint, it's seems reasonable there in Singapore, but we'll just have to kind of see what happens in terms of what jurisdictions make the most sense for people. The competition is on, right? We're seeing these Bitcoin communities around the world try to grow their own patch. We're seeing things, whether it's Bitcoin Ikasi in South Africa or Boracay, that island in the Philippines, where they're trying to do Bitcoin everywhere, or even existing cities today. So I know actually recently I was in Amsterdam for Bitcoin Amsterdam, but there's another city called Arnhem. I think it's Arnhem City or something. And they've got a whole bunch of Bitcoin businesses that have already been accepting Bitcoin for years. So that's an interesting one for some people. I know the Netherlands doesn't have a capital gains tax, but they have a wealth tax, and there's a few things like this. So yeah, it'll just be interesting to see where that competition goes. And I think the point that libertarians should focus on is, hey, competition is good. So we're going to see more jurisdictions who are forced to compete for you. And that's only a good thing in most cases. And the more likely scenario that I see is smaller states having an incentive or something to fight for, and understanding that they need to compete to attract people, whether that's investment or employees or talented entrepreneurs. So that's how I'm viewing it.
It strikes me that smaller states already know they have to compete. It's just whether or not they've understood that Bitcoin's a brilliant tool for doing that. And the bottom up kind of brilliantly, I'm going to use the word insidious, which is normally a negative phrase, but like Bitcoin just seeps into everything. And there'll be someone somewhere that realizes that they're in a small city somewhere or a small state that Bitcoin's perfect for. And they'll go and orange pill the president, which is what Andre is going to tell me, I'm sure, is a story when he could get him on. Stefan, an hour or so has flown by. Thank you so much for your time. Where can people reach out and get in touch if they want to do so?
Yeah, sure. So the best place is StefanLavera.com and of course, swan.com for anyone who wants to stack Bitcoin or learn about Bitcoin. We have a lot of free resources for people who want to learn about Bitcoin, things like free books, and we have a range of products. So even as an example, if you wanted to have a Bitcoin benefit plan, so if people want to have, you know, for their employees to earn a bit of Bitcoin every month, that's an example that we have. So yeah, there's a lot of things there, but yeah, mainly find me online on Twitter at Stefan Lavera, and I'm sharing a lot of stuff out there. But yeah, awesome. Thanks Jake for having me.
No, my pleasure. Thank you, Stefan. Okay, friends, nice work. You made it all the way to the end of the episode. Thank you so much for taking the time to listen to this conversation. As I said at the start, if you have any questions, then please don't hesitate to reach out. And if you enjoyed the episode, then please rate, like, subscribe, and share. That's it for now. Enjoy the rest of your day. All the best, Jake.